The Steamrollers Adventures podcast contains mature language and situations. Discretion is advised.
The Steamrollers Adventure podcast is brought to you by
Jack Monkey Games. Please visit www.jackmonkeygames.com and check out the Roll vs. Roll card deck. The Kickstarter is going on right now. Roll vs. Roll works with any RPG system to help new and experienced players develop their characters during a session without pulling time away from gameplay. That's right off the site. Go check it out, folks. Jackmonkeygames.com and listen for their spot right after the first segment of our show. Now let's get to it.
Episode 17.
Hey, thank you for joining us for our very first recap special.
This special presentation of the Steamrollers Adventure Podcast will bring you up to speed on the stories of Charles Humphrey, Jameson Mayfield, and Martin Barnett.
We understand that a story that grows as it goes will have some hiccups along the way, and there will be twists and turns you didn't expect, and...
and bouts of high action sandwiched between long stretches of absolute boredom.
Ahem.
Oh. I mean long stretches of absolute boredom sandwiched by short bouts of high action.
Anyway, yes, this is the episode that will bring it all together. This is our encapsulated recap.
You could technically just listen to episode zero, then this episode, and continue along.
Well, yeah, if you're new to the show and you're just interested in the story, I suppose you could do that. But then you'd definitely miss out on all the funny moments and all the cool little asides and the crack-ups and not to mention the cool sound effects and the original music and whatnot that we have throughout. And our trivia spectacular shows. Don't forget those.
Meh.
Robbie, initiate contact protocol.
Yes, sir. You can listen to the Steamrollers Adventure Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play Music, or download episodes at www.rigstories.com/thepodcast. The show notes of each episode include a link to our direct RSS feed, so you can use your podcatcher of choice. You can also download episodes directly from our website.
I actually use RSS Radio, the RSS Radio app. This is a free plug for them. It lets you decide how to group, store, and listen to podcasts. It has a lot of great features. I like how you can automatically generate a playlist by telling the app how to arrange your favorite podcasts as the... what?
As I was saying, you can contact the show by writing to steamrollersadventurepodcast@gmail.com through the Contact Me link at rigstories.com, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/steamrollersadventure, or on Twitter at steamrollerspc.
Thank you, Robbie. Okay, so let's get right down to it, starting with Ray's character, Martin Barnett.
Martin Barnett was raised on the Barnett Farm in South Central Iowa by his mother, aunt and uncle, and his cousins, Wallace and Reed. He has a mechanical left arm following a bad plane crash at the age of 14.
He was the oldest of three boys on the farm, but he didn't work as much as they did, or as much as his uncle Lyle would have liked. He was employed as a crop duster just outside of town at Pratt Airfield.
And his last day as a crop duster ended with two major events.
Well, three, if you count the fact that he actually finally got a girlfriend.
First, he sees something strange.
While flying over the O'Reilly farm. Okay, as you're coming back around, you happen to notice someone jumping from the second story of the O'Reilly farmhouse.
What?
And sprinting at an ungodly speed into the brown husks of corn.
You don't say.
I do say. I just said. Whoever it was, they looked naked.
Really?
Can't tell the gender at your altitude and speed, but as you fly over, you saw someone climb out and jump from the second story window of the O'Reilly farmhouse and run like...
ooh, someone done been cheating.
Zipping naked into the cornfield.
I'm going to bank around again and see if I can find him in the cornfield. I'm going to come down low.
Here's what you see. Whoever was running through the field, you see what they're running to? There's a group of them. Five total. All naked, so it seems. And they're dragging someone. They're dragging a woman in a dress.
And then he gets the girl.
Thanks.
Sarah's like, Martin, you wanted to say something? She like looks around, see what you're looking at. She didn't notice... you're noticing, but...
I'll drink some punch.
Yes?
You,
yes?
What day is this?
Day of the week?
Yeah.
Saturday.
You doing anything next Saturday?
No.
Do you want to?
Yes. Yes, I'll go out with you.
And then war breaks out. Fellow citizens of the Empire, I regret to inform you that on the 23rd of September, a corporate interest of Thorn and Hearst Acquisitions was brazenly attacked by the forces of the American Confederation.
People are like, it's really dead quiet now. They're all looking at each other and jaws are dropping open.
It's
like,
wool.
Yeah, this does not sound like another report on what crops are going to be like.
I'm off the hook then.
Yeah.
The attack was not sanctioned by the Hall of Thinking Machines, and we will not stand idly by and allow the Confederation to bully us or to disrupt our way of life. 2 days ago, our appointed speakers to the machines were detained outside of Baton Rouge and denied access to Eve.
No.
We have no recourse other than to declare an act of global treason and prepare ourselves for war. Though I regret the necessity, effective immediately, I am authorizing the Imperial Union Code Conscription Act all able-bodied citizens aged 14 to 54.
I'm going to get down on my knees.
Are to register at the nearest conscription center.
You don't have to.
Yeah, then there's a lot of chatter, people talking as the Emperor's voice goes into sign-off mode.
And then a sky captain recruits him as a fighter pilot.
So you're saying we're all involved anyway.
You could choose not to be. You could stay in your nice cushy farm and piss all over the crops as you've been with your pretty little junk plane, but just give it time, and if the Confederations pull out ahead of this, and let's face it, they've got more manpower than we do, they're going to burn everything that you know and love, and I hate to think of what they would do to that pretty girl in there. I'll tell you what.
He reaches to the wings on his breast.
Yeah.
And unclips them, and he clips them on your shirt.
You take those. Those are the wings of a sky captain. Think about it.
How long do I have?
24 hours.
Despite the sudden buzz in town about the onset of war with the American Confederation, Martin is determined to solve the mystery of the O'Reilly Farm incident. So he gathers up the oldest of his two cousins, Wallace, and his new girlfriend, Sarah, and they take the family car out to investigate. Keep in mind, at this point, it's pretty dark out, and they have no idea what they'll run into out there. But Martin is determined to prove that he had seen something.
Another distraction in town allows them to make a quick run for adventure without their parents catching them.
Right. A line of emergency vehicles speeds out of town toward a fire at a local dairy farm. Moments later, Wallace, Martin, and Sarah arrive at the O'Reilly farm under a starry sky. The house is dark, and the door is unlocked.
And lights come on downstairs.
All right.
In the foyer.
The foyer.
Want to call out and see if anybody's here?
Sarah is like behind you, like clutching you, like scared to death. And Wallace steps in. He's like, Mr. O'Reilly? Mrs. O'Reilly? Anybody? John?
Do they have a phone?
Nope. They didn't have a phone or a telegraph. He steps in, moves to the room to the right, is the dining room. Shines the light around in there. There's lanterns. He finds a lantern, some matches, lights it up. He turns, gives the lantern to you.
All right.
Yeah, got a handle on it.
I'll get this gun, do we?
Do you want to take the torch?
No, I'll take the lantern.
All right.
At least I can swing it.
Next room is the kitchen.
Okay.
Dark, no sign of anything. Next room, circling around, would be the underside of the stairs. There's a door that goes down to the basement. That's a crack.
Crack.
It's dark, yeah.
The door's ajar?
Door's ajar.
Oh.
Going down into the basement.
I think nothing's down there.
You're all going to die down there.
Nothing ever happens in the basement.
No.
The hell was that?
Something running upstairs. I said something. I'm sorry. I meant someone. Obviously, it's someone. Sarah screams again. Whirls around. Wallace whirls around with the flashlights. There's lights flashing everywhere. They're like spinning around trying to, you know, shining up. Like you're going to see through the ceiling that what's running upstairs. Then you hear like a thump outside, like on the ground.
Yeah.
And then you hear corn stalks.
Grab a glass of water with you.
So they rush outside where Martin has seen the naked man jump from the second story window.
Keep in mind, they never investigated upstairs nor in the basement. It won't be until much later that we find out what happened there.
All right, roll a 20.
11.
All right.
At that time.
As you whirl around to when you're just holding the lantern in your right and the poker in your left, as you whirl around, there's a blur. Something jumps down, grabs Sarah by the shoulders, and rips her to the side. Wallace's lights shine on it. It's a man-ish thing, about 4.5 feet tall, maybe a little taller.
Uh-huh.
Gray mottled skin, scars all over its body. It's wearing like a loincloth that seems to be crudely sewn out of flesh.
Oh, lovely.
It has long feet with sharp toenails. It has long nails on its fingers. Eyes seem insanely crazy.
What kind of eyes does it have?
Crazy eyes.
I mean, humanoid eyes or
the eyes of a beast?
Like the eyes of a feral human.
They fight for their lives against a handful of vicious, slavering, ghoul-like monsters. Robbie, tell the folks about ghouls.
The origin of ghouls is explained in the novel Clockwork Looking Glass depicts the diminutive monsters as the failed male members of a government project to create magic-wielding weapons out of children. The Imperial Chemical Corporation, known as Glass and Christian, kidnapped scores of children and subjected them to years of torturous experiments. Kind of like what they did to Wade Wilson in Deadpool.
Okay.
Many of the girls who survived became witches, and some of the witches became extremely powerful.
More on witches when we get to the Jameson Mayfield story.
Yes, but the boys did not become what the GNC scientists and mad doctors had hoped. Instead, they became carnivorous, underground-dwelling, mutant cannibal killing machines. The monsters grew into hordes of night-stalking beasts who would kidnap women for breeding purposes, because there are no female ghouls.
Yeah, so Martin, Wallace, and Sarah have a run-in with these horrific monsters.
Total?
Yeah. Nice.
That you're bleeding, clapping. You're getting weaker.
Roll a 20.
Roll a 20?
Yep.
17. Ooh. Maybe that's the good news.
All right. This time you clocked it in the head and spun it around, you get an extra attack.
Ooh!
It's hurt.
Roll a 20?
Yep.
After successfully beating back the beasts, our trio gets into the car and rushes to where they had seen the fire.
In the hopes of gaining assistance from emergency services.
Correct. They're injured and panicked, but now Martin has more witnesses to what happened at the O'Reilly farm, and he hopes that he could get some help from the local authorities. Unfortunately, the strangeness of the town only gets thicker when they meet a military roadblock preventing them from getting to help.
All right, folks, I'm going to need to see your identification. So one at a time, starting with you, sir. He points to Wallace. Step forward, empty out your pockets. And Menske has his rifle pointed at you and Sarah, like from the hip, but obviously keeping you covered.
Do we look like we're threatening?
Shut up.
Defeated, dejected, and also a bit mystified by Martin's rapid healing process.
Again, like Deadpool.
Robbie, we recorded the show long before that movie came out.
But...
And I'm not a comic book nerd, and I have never read any of the pool stories. Still, I do admit the similarities are there, but then again, Martin's origin is a lot like any other superhero story. The question is, will he become a hero? Okay, so he and Wallace and Sarah return to the Barnett farm, only to find a government overseer is on hand to dish out military post assignments.
Martin Barnett.
In the cupboard, in the corner.
Yeah.
No service.
Must be because of my metal arm.
It is.
They don't like your robot arm.
Your 4F.
Oh.
You can swallow it, Uncle Barnett. Bring it, Uncle Barnett.
What else do I have here? And let's see, who else do we have here?
He looks around. Say nothing about Sarah.
Oh, Sarah DeLeon, 102nd Armored.
Armored?
You should point out that Martin does not kiss the girl.
Right. Much to the laughter and jibing and pokes of George, instead, this happens.
Take the coat and hand it back to her and tell her to keep it.
She clutches it to her chest and her eyes get all teary. So...
I may not be a smart man, but I do know what love is.
That one's staying in.
Oh.
I'm going to miss you, Marty.
I'm going to give her a hug.
Okay.
Come on!
She'll hug you back and kiss you on the cheek and then turn around and run.
All right, so after everyone disperses, hangdog expressions leading them out to their last night as Imperial citizens before they become members of the military machine, Martin decides to go track down Sky Captain Klein and take him up on his offer of service, despite being branded 4F. With Pratt's airfield closing down for government use, the only way Martin's going to fly is if he joins the military. So he and his mother head out to register for military service. What, Robbie?
I'm stuck on your use of the expression hangdog.
Robbie.
Oh, all right. It is at this point that Martin's mother reveals a vital bit of background information, and we discover how he was able to heal so quickly after the run-in with the ghouls.
Martin, you're...
Spit it out, woman!
I think I'm going to turn the radio.
You're not human.
What did you say?
Are you maintaining the road? Roll a 20. Oh. While you're maintaining your driving, she drops this bomb
and
on you.
Crashes into a tree.
8. Do I get any bonuses? I was going to turn on the radio. Do I get a +2 for that?
No. There is no radio in the car.
What do you mean I'm not human?
You,
Our dog?
I feel human.
Your father was born of a ghoul. Your grandfather, Victor, was a ghoul.
My what?
Your grandfather was a ghoul.
Yeah, you're a quarter ghoul.
You're a quarter hellion.
How could that be possible?
So they get into town, have a heartfelt parting, and Martin finally meets with Wing Taquito, a kite pilot officer from Tornado Base, Iowa, who agrees to bring the skilled young crop duster into their ranks.
A long time passes, and Martin trains as a fighter pilot with his new friend and rival, Charlie Dodge Stoddard. He has not seen or heard from his mother, cousins, or Sarah since the declaration of war.
Right. And war hasn't officially begun. So far, there's just been a lot of clandestine training, preparation, planning, etc. It's as though the Empire was gearing up for something huge, but secretly.
Oh, you find out in George's story that he's behind...
Save it, Robbie. Yeah, so then one day, Martin is greeted by his old friend, Sky Captain Klein. Klein, along with a government agent named Fox, say they want to recruit Martin to finally get to the bottom of what happened at the O'Reilly farm a couple of months back. Martin agrees, says his farewells to Dodge Stoddard. Then this happens.
You should just talk to him, you know?
Okay.
Do you put your hands up or anything?
Yeah, I'll put my hands up.
All right.
What you talking about?
I thought we were here to get the files.
Hacksaw says,
no, we're here to close a file.
And you look at him, and he fires once right into your chest. You feel the bullet sting through your chest. Your legs disappear. You, like, fall to your knees. Your arms are, well, your one arm is, like, really weak. And then Fox fires again. That one goes right into your chest. You slump over backwards. And then Hacksaw walks up to you and goes, blind, deaf, nothing.
Oh.
The fuck?
Martin Barnett is dead!
Yes, but the next morning his eyes crackle open and he miraculously rises from the dead, his body quickly regenerating.
Like Deadpool, after Ajax
Robbie,
burns down the...
Would you lay off the Deadpool? Anyway, he comes face to face with a young, dark-haired female Imperial officer who introduces herself as Shade.
Shade is a witch name.
It is. And she's not alone. With her is a stoic, silent, mysterious stranger named Jameson Mayfield. Shade introduces herself as Adrienne Booth. She and Jameson represent a rebel movement growing to unseat the strongest military-aligned corporations in the Imperial North, particularly the company they both work for, Thorn and Hearst Acquisitions. Martin, still reeling from dying, considers this as he rests to regain his health.
But then, the diner where they're hiding out is attacked.
Hey, tin box of spoiler cogs, shut the fuck up. That's as far as Martin's story goes up to this point. For now, all right?
Yes, but then the really exciting turn happens...
Folks, why don't you enjoy a word from this week's sponsor while I pull Robbie's key?
And now, a message from Jack Monkey Games.
So here's the thing. You get a bunch of strangers together, or maybe they're friends, or maybe you went to school, or maybe somebody dated somebody's cousin. I don't know. But they're there. They're at a table. And there's these sheets in front of them, and there's this dice. And you spend a lot of time about this dice and the sheets. And they're asking you things like, what does this stat mean? And what am I supposed to do? And how strong am I? How tall am I? I don't know. It's driving you a bit nuts. Because all you want to do is tell the story. And you want them to tell the story. And you want to get into the story. And it's all just too much and crazy. So you have these cards. And you pass them around. And you say, hey, look at the cards. Look at the paper. Don't look at the dice. The dice doesn't matter. We'll get to the dice later. Figure out which card goes with the paper. But don't tell anybody. It's a secret. Let's see how well you can do. And they look at the card. And they look at the paper. And they decide, I can do this. Ooh, that sounds fun. And hey, I never thought of this person in that way in this scenario before. And the next thing you know, they're not paying attention to the dice. They're paying attention to the story. And they're paying attention to each other. They're listening. Because they got to figure it out. Who's doing what? For what reason? Can they figure it out? Can they get away with it? Can they get the extra points they need to get that whiz, bang, sweet, cool thing at the end of the game that they can't possibly afford otherwise? Good questions. You should get a deck of cards, pass them out, and figure out the answers.
Roll versus Roll Kickstarter going on right now.
JackMonkeyGames.com.
All right, we're back. Okay, Robbie, who's next?
The Adventure of Jameson Mayfield.
Tell us about him.
Jameson Mayfield was born into a large, wealthy Confederation family in the Deep South. And though his father had money and his mother was a lady of grace, the true political power of the Confederation, he chose to set out and find fortune in the Empire, the undisputed core of capitalism in the entire world. So he set out with just the clothes on his back to become a powerfully successful man all on his own without the help of his parents, much like foolish children of this generation.
Robbie, no commentary. Exactly. And that's what led him to the imperial capital of New York City. He spent years building up his street smarts, winning back alley pugilistic competitions to get enough money to buy food.
Plain toast.
Yeah, apparently that's his favorite food. So he saves up every dime and penny to get a flashy suit and decides, fuck it, I'll start at the very top. So he goes to interview at Thorn and Hearst Acquisitions, the number one corporation in the IUS. But there was something strange about this interview right out of the box.
Sitting there with your hat in your lap, clock ticking.
That's fine. I'm a very patient person.
A body falls past the window.
Whatever.
Seriously, how do you react? You see the body of a man fall past the window.
I would just glance at it and be like, my character is very calm. He's calm. He's very.
Or he's had something.
I'm trying to get the job as a corporate detective. I have to be aware and calm. And
for some reason, Stanton Davis, a Thorn and Hearst agent and interviewer, immediately took to Jameson's extremely cold, calculating, and vile streak. I mean, here's a man unaffected by death and the harsh cruelties of the corporate empire.
He is teamed up with a senior investigator named Daniel S. Booth, who goes by his middle name, Samuel.
Right, yeah. Interesting trivia fact there, Robbie. Thanks. And he is immediately put to work tracking down an embezzler from the company. Jameson and Booth follow a set of clues that lead them to the mid-level accountants for Thorn and Hearst. But when they go to confront the man, this happens.
All right, here we are. Frederick Gressman. He steps in front of the door. A hole this big splinters, other small holes around it. There is nothing left of Booth's face.
Oh, no.
He's thrown back against the wall from the blast of the shotgun.
The beautiful mustache is gone?
What?
Oh,
all
no.
That's left is the mustache.
Big mustache. The mustache is stuck to the wall behind him.
Oh, wow. No.
His body slumps back against the wall, slides down to the ground. You hear the cocking of a shotgun.
Gonna take his weapon.
And when he slumps down there is a pistol in the shoulder holster that you see.
Cool.
So what do you do?
I'm gonna try to do a roll on the ground and grab the pistol and end up on the other side of the door where they can't see me.
Okay. Let's roll a 20.
And that's when Jameson wakes up.
Correct. From the moment he walked into Thorn and Hearst offices, Jameson was being watched. He was somehow tagged and drugged even before meeting with Davis, and his entire interview was some kind of ghastly probe into the workings of his mind. It should come as no surprise that a character with such a dark streak would get the job at Thorn and Hearst. And if you've read Clockwork Looking Glass, you know what Thorn and Wolf was like. Thorn and Wolf, Thorn and Hearst, same thing.
The next day, he receives a call. Davis says a car is going to pick him up for a meeting at the Leviathan building.
Right. Except the car of thug-like men in black suits and trench coats don't take him to the Leviathan building. Instead, they take him to the New York Harbor, the yacht club. He's cornered, and this happens.
Six at all.
You know, he's going to be dead before we meet him.
I got a six.
Oh, my God.
Blew the guy's head off.
All right. You swing, you grab the one guy. You got him in a real good chokehold. He, like, goes up to hold your arms defensively, but he's a very effective shield. The other hand swings back, and basically, without even looking more than a glance, you fire a single shot right between the eyes.
What type of gun was this?
It's like a 38 revolver.
Okay. I was hoping it wasn't one of those big boom-booms.
Oh, like the one, yeah. Yeah.
No, there's a hole in the yacht.
No, it's not a gearbox hand cannon. There's a hole in the sky now. No, you pretty much blow the guy with the billy club away. He crumples down behind you. What do you do now?
I tell them that, gentlemen, this can go two ways. You could explain the situation, or not all of us will be leaving.
That's apparent. The one guy's dead already.
Before anyone else dies, Jameson is met by a guy named Travers, one of the heads of a rival corporation, Roebuck & Wellington. Travers offers Jameson a huge stack of cash if he'll essentially come to work for R&W, presumably as a double agent. Just as Jameson agrees,
I have connections. So, would you like to join a winning team?
Absolutely, sir.
Ask for more.
Really? Well then, I'll just make sure that all of a sudden,
there's the sound of breaking glass.
The sound of rock?
Breaking glass. As the portal, one of the port, there we go, the portal word again. The porthole.
Porthole.
Gets a bullet hole in it. And a hole appears right in his forehead. Perfectly. Just perfectly. As he was moving, his head snaps back. His eyes kind of glaze over and he slumps in his chair and falls out of it.
Oh, he just committed murder.
And then you hear the shot.
Better get down.
So it's faster than the speed of sound.
It's from a long distance.
Quite a distance away. You can pocket the money, yes.
Cool. Oh, I'm pocketing the money, along with grabbing the pistol that was on the desk.
Okay.
Yeah, check out the other drawers. Take it all.
So what?
Sail away in the ship too.
So then, what do you do?
Well, I'm gonna drop to the ground, you know, away from any portholes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll check to see what's on his person.
Not even cold yet.
a pocket watch. He has a corporate ident. A identification that make him the number two acquisitions officer for Roebuck and Wellington. Is essentially putting him equal to Mr. Davis, who interviewed you.
So now they have a position open. You should apply for that.
Maybe a couple $100.
Okay.
Doesn't seem to be a lot of commotion or anything because nobody really heard what happened. And then outside this cabin, you hear a body fall. And it rolls down the narrow steps where you had fought the guys before. And it
must be Cecil coming to get you.
It was the guy who you gave the bloody nose to with the back of your head. His body falls back, and his head turns toward you, and you see he has a perfect bullet hole right in the middle of his forehead as well. And he had, like, tissue stuffed up his nose to staunch the bleeding from your headbutt.
Wow.
Not that it would help now, and you can't really stuff any tissues into his little brain hole there. Yeah. He is dead. You hear shouting, a couple of gunshots, and a couple more bodies fall. Shots immediately stop. What do you do?
Going towards the stairs.
Okay. At the very top of the stairs is another dead man with a bullet hole perfectly in the middle of his forehead, just like the other ones.
Maybe you're in another dream state.
Whoever this is a correct shot, though.
Mm-hmm.
Let me say, it's a good shot.
Yeah, and you are hearing the echoing shots, like, sometime after the impact, indicating that, yeah, this person's very far away. That's making these perfect shots. So do you go up above deck?
Could I just kind of look to see?
You can, and you see everybody's dead. You have the very clear impression that you're completely out of danger, that whoever was taking these shots was shooting was not meant for you. Yes. Here comes a car.
Okay.
Oh, geez.
It's
a black sedan, just like that first one, is pulling up behind that one. It seems to slow down, and whoever is driving it flashes the lights twice, in signaling you, evidently. What do? You're standing on the gangway as you were heading up.
I shall take the gun and place it in my coat and walk towards it.
Okay. The driver's side door opens on the vehicle, and a short woman in a black coat steps out. Her hair is so drawn back in a black bun.
Mrs. Adriana Booth.
Miss Adriana Booth.
Miss Adriana Booth.
She steps around and
that's dumb.
She says, "Thank God you're okay."
It was her. She's a sniper.
Well, yeah, she is. She has a long-barreled rifle.
She has a sniper, yep.
I remember that. Oh, awesome. I'll tell her.
Yeah. And though you don't see it, she has it on her.
Oh, where could that be hiding?
That's awesome.
Well.
Glove check.
She says,
I was aiming for you.
It was lucky that I was able to find you here because when I got to the hotel where I was supposed to pick you up, did Miss Timson or anybody tell you that I was to be the driver?
No.
Well, at least you're okay.
Be waiting.
She looks past you and she's like, RW. Is this a Roebuck and Wellington?
Adrienne Booth, daughter of Sam Booth and member of the Witches' Arsenal Corps, is the one...
Though Jameson doesn't realize she's a witch yet and doesn't know that her sniper skill was actually some kind of complex bullet wish spell.
Right. She wants to know if he was going to take Travers's deal. It seems she's just as shady as Jameson.
Fits. Her name is Shade. After a quick bite to eat, again, toast, Adrienne takes Jameson to the heavily armed fortress of the Leviathan building. There he meets with Agent Booth, her father, and gets his very first assignment. Protect an assassin being sent across enemy lines into the Confederation is being sent to kill a man named Robert Hillary. Hillary apparently has secrets stolen from the Empire's number one company, and it looks like he's planning to sell those secrets to the Confeds.
The assassin? None other than the witch sniper, Booth's daughter, Adrienne!
Right. So Jameson is given a very slick sword cane, a suit of clothes, a sack of Trinity Bibles, and the undercover identity of the Reverend David Clausen, with Adrienne posing as his wife, and the two become a pair of Confederate citizens looking to fly back home to Atlanta.
But they never make it to Atlanta.
What? What are you going to say?
Shirt.
Everybody thinks you're a Confederate. Maybe you can enlist to help with the other people.
Stage a riot.
And you don't blow your cover.
Adrienne says, do you trust me?
Absolutely.
We've only known each other a few days, but I really need to know if you trust me.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Wait here. She goes back up towards the curtains, towards the front. What are you going to do?
That's your clue to get naked.
What do you do?
I'll just make sure that my staff is, you know.
You mean your walking rod? Stick?
Yeah.
My walking stick?
Right.
Sorry, I said staff.
There's a difference.
Yeah, my walking stick.
You are a holy man, though.
All right, she comes back after a few minutes. She, like, takes you by the arm to pull you close. Nobody else has come back here. They're content to sit in the chairs for a while and play cards, smoke, and read a bit, because you could smell cigarettes and pipes and whatever. Mm-hmm. We're heading to Iowa. There's a containment camp we're being taken to. Once we're there, they're going to divide us up for labor.
Iowa's nice this time of year.
So what are your ideas?
We have to get to Atlanta.
I agree.
Take over plane.
We're going to have to...
cause a ruckus.
We can't disrupt this flight.
Disrupt this flight.
And I can't take us off of it.
Disrupt this flight.
So what she's saying is you're going to Iowa. You have to find a way from there.
Yep. Now mistaken for the Confederates they were posing as, Jameson and Adrienne find themselves separated in a horrific work camp right out of Schindler's List.
Not at all like something out of Deadpool. What?
You're obsessing. Anyway, aboard the sky train to this camp, which is located yards from the very military camp where Martin Barnett was earning his wings, they meet a furniture maker named Thomas and his brother. Upon landing, Thomas's brother, well, this happens.
You witness a woman stepping out of the group. She's being pulled away from her husband because the men and women and children are being divided into three groups.
Steerage and first class.
I don't like it.
Worse. So as she's being pulled away, her husband runs to intervene. Says, "I don't treat my wife that way." The guard turns, shoots her in the head.
Whoa.
And everybody witnesses this and absolutely loses their shit. Screaming in panic, falling to the ground. The children are crying, whatever. The guy immediately moves to another, just a random guy, shoots him right in the head. And then there's lots of shouting and screaming and say, you know, stand in line, do exactly as you're said or you're going to be next.
Would that be the officer that's standing on my porch now?
No.
Good.
If it were, I couldn't tell you. So this horrific thing happens, and as you and Adrienne are split apart, and she's staying in character with the, you know, my husband, but she tells you, everybody listen, because this is going to be another shocker.
Loyal Glass.
She says, listen for the sign, Loyal Glass.
Damn, am I good.
She also tells you, conform. But never look away from their eyes.
What?
David, never look away from their eyes. Always keep their eyes. Loyal Glass.
Weeks pass in the camp, and Jameson becomes the subject of suspicion and revulsion. He gets more food than anyone else. He gets more blankets. He's ignored by the spotlights and the guards as long as he looks them in the eye. But suspicions go both ways, and he overhears the phrase Adrienne left him with, Loyal Glass. This time it's spoken by Thomas and his new friend, a British Confederate named Foley.
So he follows them to a secret meeting where Jameson is almost stabbed in the back.
And they find out that a guard named Gillian Kay is on their side.
Yes, an insider.
Reverend, I think they're going
to
kill you.
You don't have to like it. Were he a saintly man, he would have the same treatment from the Lord.
A fourth person comes running over, hunched over, like sort of like thousand year guys, little huddle, and says...
The precious. What's going on? Who's he?
It's a woman's voice. He heard it.
Heard what?
And the Foley guy says, he heard the pass. Not only that, he looked right at the light and they didn't shoot him.
He's a spy.
Why didn't they shoot him? Why didn't they shoot
Must
you?
Be.
Because he's a spy.
Look at him.
The divine faith of the Trinity.
I think you better give that up.
Foley knife him. Foley's like trying to find his dropped sharpened stick.
I'll look at Foley.
Durr. Does it work?
Yeah, he stops.
So Jameson becomes aware of the greater plot afoot, and the conspirators agree to include them in their plans, though they don't. But the very next day, Adrienne returns in full uniform, driving a staff car directly into the camp and right up next to the line of prisoners. She has Jameson get in, and they drive right through the gates of the prison, right out the door.
It's time for her to tell him that she's part of the rebellion as well. Or seems to be. She has secret knowledge that has tipped certain scales in her mind.
It's over.
Snap out of it.
It's all over. There's no corporation. There's no job. There's no money.
Oh, they're kicking you out. Your service has been terminated.
If Thorne and Wolf succeeds, Thorne and Hearse, Thorne, if Bradford fucking Thorne succeeds, the Empire is going to crumble. There's a movement, a rebellion against Thorn and Hearse. You have had a Thorn and Hearse ident. You have a Thorn and Hearse pin. I have that. I'm a WAC. We're in trouble. You have to see something. We have to collect whatever we can to get out of this. I need to know if I can trust you. If I can't, then what's the fucking point? She like turns there's like a cloth bag like sewn onto the door because it's like a Model T. It's not like, you know. Mm. And she pulls out a long-barreled stainless revolver. She hands it to you, handle first.
It's just like Bonnie and Clyde.
Take it.
Where's her dad?
She puts both hands on the wheel, closes her eyes. She says, they're glass. Glass is the only thing that's going to kill me. You can get rid of me. You can take the car. Take a train. Take a fucking sky train. Airship. Go back to New York, tell Bradford Thorne you saw the whole thing, blow the whistle. I'm sure he'll promote you. All you have to do is kill me.
Now's your chance.
What do you do?
All that power that you always wanted.
That's right.
All the money you've always wanted.
All the women.
I would just place the gun in the glove box. If there is even is a glove box.
Yeah, there is.
Yeah, let's put the gun in the glove box.
You'll have all the gold you can eat.
Uh-huh.
She opens her eyes and looks at you, knowing that now she's not going to be shot. And
at least not today.
She wasn't right. Going to be shower guard.
Well, yeah, she could have been. You could have done that.
You're getting soft in your old age.
Just because our Canadian friend drew a picture of her doesn't mean that she can't die. I mean, look, Martin died.
I know.
Bringing that up again.
Sorry.
She was going to draw your next, but I guess not.
I know. She can draw me on the ground with X's over my eyes.
All right.
To be totally honest, guys, I didn't say I needed power in Thorn and Hearst. I just need power.
Well, that would have been a great way to get it.
She puts the car in gear and heads out again. She says, we have to get as many people.
And she also knows where to find someone who can help them.
Martin.
Yes.
Shade comes in. She goes, oh, good, you didn't leave. Are you all right?
I'm feeling better.
I brought you some food. She produces a bag out of nothing.
Oh, I looked at him first.
Yeah. What do you do?
That?
You are... Yeah. I can't eat that. A bag of food?
Yes.
Ooh. Well, I'll reach in and grab some because I am hungry.
Okay. It's fresh fruit, mainly.
Help get my color back into my face?
Yeah, a little bit. It's not too cold in here anymore.
Good.
She says,
you're so great.
This is Jameson. My given name is Adrienne Booth.
Okay, Shade.
Well,
Shade was my witch name. She glances at Jameson. Because it's more she's actually disclosed about herself than she has before.
Thank you, Shade.
Thanks for everything.
She grabs the papers from nearby, the ones that you didn't destroy, and she hands them to you. Look.
Yeah, he doesn't need to know about me.
I'll shift through all the papers.
So, ghoul attack. Not only that, he was dead. They shot him. She points out the window. Actually, coming in here, you saw the two bodies, and you know it was her handiwork.
Headshot.
She mentally headshot him, and they brought him out here to execute him. I figured we could use him with what we talked about, someone with that kind of regenerative power.
I'm listening to their conversation while I'm eating.
Mm-hmm.
Wondering who the hell he is.
And that's where Jameson Mayfield meets Martin Barnett.
And now that two of our three players have come together, it's time to enter my contest! Throughout the Steamrollers Adventure podcast, the guys often slip into impressions from movies, disjointed lines from movies, or off-the-wall movie references. I have collected 25 movie references and edited them into a 50-second block.
You need only guess as many movies as you can
to be entered to win an autographed copy of the paperback novel Clockwork Looking Glass, the book that launched this podcast. Send your guess to steamrollersadventurepodcast@gmail.com with the subject line 25 in 50. You may also visit www.rickstories.com and click the contact link and use the subject line 25 in 50 in the submission form. One winner will be drawn at random, so enter often. Best of luck. And now, 25 movie references in 50 seconds. Good luck.
Four fried chickens and a Coke.
Soap, not lie.
Stay gold, pony boy.
Matt Damon.
May the odds be ever so in your favor. You sure got a pretty mouth.
Greater honor for me.
You must have a different Cisco sister.
Buku movement.
Erno, I'm sick of talking about Erno.
Groovy, baby.
She's a very good driver.
She thought your name was Calvin Klein.
Anakin Skywalker, Obi-Wan Kenobi.
I
look like Scott. So you do not be a little bit jumpy.
There's a snake in this motherfucking plane.
Damn your eyes.
Too late.
It's a fine idea, Pinback.
There's a snake in my boot.
The bear Jew.
The bear Jew. Central Services. We do the work, you do the pleasure. I squirt a few and you let me go.
I got nipples, fucker. Can you milk me?
Molly, 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 molly.
Or swing away.
Swing away.
Treasure ball! Treasure ball!
Good luck.
Welcome back, folks. Okay, now it's time to hear the strange tale of Cecil B. Griffith.
Alias Reginald Gray.
Alias Charles Humphrey.
Alias Dr. Elias Carson.
The point is, George's character spends most of his story trying to figure out who he really is, or what he really is.
And that's important, because bad things happen when he blacks out.
But before we get to that point, Mr. Humphrey, at this point Cecil, had to get to the Empire. He believed he was defecting from the Confederate-aligned Great Britain, so he sneaks aboard a Russian freighter and ends up on a beach on Nantucket Island. There, he is greeted by who becomes known as the Crazy Crab Man, who not only knows his current alias, but also seems to predict a future where Cecil will rain blood down upon the entire world.
Oh, he's almost like he's cowering behind you, and he's, oh, she's here somewhere. I saw her face. I saw her ghostly white face. She's staring at me. She's coming for me. She's looking at me.
Well, why don't we leave this island?
No. If you leave the island, she will pull you underwater and you will drown.
Well, how about we just walk?
No. You can't. You can't, Cecil. He called you by name.
Father?
How do you know my...
It's his dad.
Cecil Bernard Griffith. Yeah, he like calls you by name. Crazy wild-eyed guy.
I think he read your mind.
And how do you know this?
I know about the fire coming down from the sky and the explosions of blood.
Dear Lord.
The explosions of blood. Your glorious explosions of blood! He turns and takes off running down the beach.
I'm gonna take off running.
And that's where the lovely but mysterious, helpful Molly Rose comes to play.
Yes, he gets to the lighthouse and is welcomed in by Molly Rose, who is someone who takes in wanderers looking to defect to other countries. That's where Cecil meets a Confederate colonel by the name of Mitch Jackson III.
He takes another big bite of the stew, looking at you.
So why you want to come here?
Oh, I don't have it on me. I gave it to the lady. I heard some things. Didn't set well with me, because I, like you probably, as I hear it all you Brits is, I like to consider myself a gentleman and a man of moral integrity.
Exactly.
And when I heard that the Confederation has plans to launch against the Imperial United States, a sneak attack using massive weapons.
What kind of weapons?
Rockets. Rockets filled with poisons.
Then he blacks out and murders him.
He has a russet, part of his uniform was a russet cross belt and waist belt that had a number of pouches on it, an ammunition pouch, and a scabbard that is now empty.
The scabbard is?
Yes. There's something in your boot.
I'll check my boot.
There's a snake in your boot.
There's a snake in my boot. Yeah, you're about to go out a window, infinity and beyond.
I can fly.
There is a, maybe a foot-long dagger. Confederate. It's got, CF engraved on it for Confederation. And it's Confederate military, and it fits that scabbard perfectly, and it's bloody. Roll a 20.
11. Natural.
You suddenly have a flash. You're somewhere else. It's dark. You're knee-deep in seawater. And you hear him say, Colonel Jackson say,
"What are we doing out here looking for this crazy crab, man?"
You whip around like a helicopter and phew, right across his throat. And he falls to his knees in the ocean. As he's falling forward, you grab his hair, shove his face underwater, and you hold him down until... red starts to, even though it's dark, but when the lighthouse beam goes by, you see the red coming out.
Confused by his situation, and at this point, almost accusing Molly of having something to do with it, Cecil is ready to bolt with the battle plans he took from the deceased Colonel Jackson. He had a punch card that told of a sneak attack the Confederation was planning to launch against the Empire, and Jackson had come to warn the Empire to keep everything fair and up all above board.
But he was wrong on all counts.
Indeed. Cecil lucks out in that Molly provides him with an alias and a job in New York City. From there, he will bide his time until she can provide him with the name of a high-ranking military official.
But Cecil's blackouts become more frequent and worse.
True. And all in one fateful day, which he lives out backwards, an idea I borrowed from the movie Memento. Robbie, tell him.
Memento is based on the short story Memento Mori and starred Guy Pearce and Matrix alums Carrie Ann Moss and Joe Pantoliano. It was released in 2000. The story essentially progresses in reverse order so that the audience can live through the same short-term memory loss obstacle as the main character.
Yeah, so since Cecil, or Humphrey, whoever, is suffering from blackouts that mimicked short-term memory loss, this segment of his story progressed in reverse, starting here.
5 p.m.
And then you would hear dripping and like an echoey sound, like the kind of sound you would hear in a sewer.
Okay.
And as you open your eyes...
Is he waking up from another blackout?
You are in a sewer. You are in a New York City sewer. It's probably, it's, you know, round stone walls. There is a grate not far from you going up the city street, and you hear horses and, you know, street buskers and people passing by. But wait, there's more.
Oh, good.
There is someone with you.
Oh.
A man sitting on a box wearing a perfectly coiffed three-piece suit with a like a tweed jacket and a nice plaid vest underneath. He even has a carnation in his jacket. He has, you know, like a nice tie. Very neat, clean, proper black hair, you know, neatly combed underneath his hat, bowler. Which is a bowler. He's got a bowler hat. Also very neat, nice little feather in it. He has a nicely trimmed mustache.
Did I seem surprised, or...?
You should be, because you woke up... Not only did you wake up in a sewer, you woke up across from what appears to be an English gentleman.
Well, I'll, like, stumble backwards from where I was at.
Maybe he can tell you what happened.
And ask, who are you?
Well, sir, I am surprised.
He must be your butler.
Honestly, you don't remember me?
No.
Then what you said was true.
What did I say?
When he speaks, there is a slight... There's a peculiar hollowness to his voice. You immediately peg him as a cogman.
Ah, okay.
He is an automaton. And he looks extremely human, perfectly human. You can only identify it a little bit in his voice. There's a slight modulation, maybe.
When did we meet?
So we've known each other for years. I suppose, allow me to reintroduce myself. Nigel Edmund Wesley, your batsman.
Did I ever have a batsman named Nigel?
Nope.
Also, essentially, your valet, sir.
But I don't remember him.
No, not at all.
Well, Nigel, I'm afraid I don't remember you.
You did warn me that this would be the case, sir. And as a matter of fact, I am prepared. Do you have the password?
Maybe we can what play password? It back for you.
You were to give me a password, sir. Upon giving me the password, I will tell you everything you need to know.
But before that... This happened.
3 p.m.
That's 2 hours prior to last time. You're in a diner on Close Street.
It's called the Close Street Diner.
And you have the feeling that you're waiting for somebody, that there was somebody sitting in the booth across from you, because you see a glass of water there and a napkin that's kind of been rumpled. And also you're looking for, you know that you're looking for Nigel Wesley. A man comes to the table and he's wearing a black suit that's kind of rumpled. And when you look up at him as he like goes to sit across from you, it looks like he's been punched in the face several times. He says,
Mr. Gray, we have a new agreement, right? We have the new agreement.
Yes.
Good.
He reaches into his jacket pocket, pulls out an envelope, slides it over to you.
He's in the bathroom cleaning himself off.
I'm glad we could settle this without any more fisticuffs. All right, Mr. Gray, you've won fair and square. You have that, and there's no need to bother with us anymore. Good day.
He starts to head out. As he heads out, there's another guy sitting back in the corner who gets up and kind of follows him. And he looks like he was punched, too.
I'm going to get up and follow him.
All right. You follow them outside, and you overhear the guy who came out second, talking to the little man with the brown stash who gave you the big wad of cash. He calls him Carson. Rings a bell. Terrence Carson. The guy's name is Terrence Carson. You don't know who he is or what he's with, but the name kind of comes back to you, and it dawns on you he wasn't supposed to give you money. He was supposed to give you a key. The key used to wind up an automaton.
Which is for?
Nigel.
Without it, no Nigel. So the second guy who came out says to the little guy, as you're coming out, you hear him say, and that's it? He didn't shake you down for the key? And then the guy is like looking past you at him. And he goes, oh! And he turns and he takes off running down the street. Yeah, Carson does. And then the second guy turns and he sees you and he goes running after Carson.
I'm gonna go run after him and Carson.
Okay, chase me.
I want my key.
All right, Fog. You will be using your tenacity for your strength and tenacity. Let's go with strength because it's higher. Let's see if you can catch up to either of these guys. Yes. Roll 3 20s. It's just ahead of you. You're close enough. You're within diving range of grabbing his like ankle and bringing.
But he doesn't have the key.
No, but he's with the other guy or was chasing the other guy. One of the two.
I'm gonna reach back, grab the gun, so I'm running.
Leaping across to the next roof.
Like, tackle him.
His foot catches on the, like, roll a 20 and use. You can use your. Okay.
Plus five?
Pistol, yeah, your plus five pistol. Roll
okay,
that.
Indy.
All right, you take aim, you fire. You see a blossom of red explode from his calf. And he, like, stumbles forward, cries out, and he, like, reaches down. His leg is kind of wobbly, and smacked by a truck.
Oh!
This is he was stumbling, like breaking out of the alley, and pff, truck hits him.
And go down there and see if I can get that key.
It's more like a grazing kind of a thing.
Are you guys keeping track of your kills?
And before that...
1 p.m.
Bing.
Like
24
going backwards.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, the jacket is like new. Let's and you've just finished combing your hair, washing your face off. You have no idea where you're at or why you're here. Again, as usual, another blackout.
Do I have any change on me or anything?
You do.
I'll grab a towel from that guy.
Okay.
I'll give it to him.
Thank you, sir.
What place is this again?
Well, this is the building of the House of Cards, sir.
Oh, yes.
You are in the tournament, sir.
Yes?
Yes, of course. Just a little nervous.
Well, somebody was speaking highly of you because, you know, we don't normally let outsiders in. But you win this hand with Mr. Bowman, and I guarantee you, you'll get in and go in places.
All of the room is a small card table with two chairs. There's a lamp in the middle of the table. There is an African-American gentleman in a beige suit. Standing at one of the chairs, talking to a guard. All these other guys you recognize as having chased you in the last episode. All right, Terrence slows down a bit so that he could fill you in. Now, you remember, we're not playing for money. We're playing for information. That card you have in exchange for the information that you wanted. The key.
You Upper. Like what you see?
Let's sit on your lap.
Very pretty.
Well, you stick with us. If you win... this challenge, we'll be glad to have you. And then that will mean more for both of us. I'll let you cut.
Cut the deck.
Okay. And he shuffles. Oh, best out of three, so...
Oh, that was it then.
Yeah.
You have your rights to claim your victory, but I invite you to take this a little further.
Sweeten the pot.
Shall we sweeten the pot?
Pick out one of the girls.
The sweetened pot.
All right, then.
This is how you got in trouble in the first place. And leads on to the rest. Some more.
He stands up, shakes your hand.
I says, can I get my key?
Oh, of course. Actually, let me go get it for you. I don't have it on my person. That would be bad form.
Carson will bring it to him.
Obviously. Right? Because
how am I going to... How am I going to trust someone who's never been in my establishment before? I'll be right back. Mr. Carson will remain here with you.
He steps out. As he starts to head out, he mentions something to one of the guards just inside the door, and then he disappears.
Make sure he doesn't leave alive.
And sure enough, they're all like coming up to you, like pushing up their sleeves.
All right. I know what's coming.
Yep.
Beat down.
They're looking for a beat down, yep.
Now you black out. And...
I wake up, they're all dead.
I'm using a shoe and it's inside the guy's mouth.
Carson's like, he's actually backing toward the door as the other guys are coming up. And he's like,
we'll have to get you that key another time. Unless you'd like to score another deal. Tell you what, we'll pay you to keep it.
I'll see you on the other side.
Oh, I'll bet you will. And he leaves, which is why later he says the other deal and gives you that big wad of cash. He thought he was paying you off. But.
Okay.
Plus 15.
23.
33. 17. 27. Okay. You like hop up, kick the chair back, whip around the pistol, back between the eyes. Two of them down. The other two guys like stop right away and put their hands up.
I tell them to lie in the stomach.
Okay.
All leading back to the beginning. And once he had all the pieces together,
he had the key to unlocking the automaton Cogman's programming. Not only that, he discovered that he was actually Major Charles Humphrey, a decorated war hero of the Empire, who had been sent to Britain as a sleeper cell to launch a massive global strike.
It's around this time that he also discovers that he had been reading the card backwards. It actually speaks of a sneak attack being prepared by the Empire against the Confederate civilians.
Yeah, civilian targets. Schools, hospitals, that kind of thing. Cecil, well now, Humphrey, is a man with a conscience. He was being used. Now, he was an upstanding soldier this entire time, sure, but because he thought he was doing right. This little piece of information, which proves he was on the wrong side, leads him to turn to assist the rebellion. After regaining much of his senses as he can, Major Humphrey returns to his home in Illinois, to Fort Chamberlain, where he could find out more about his covered past.
But things quickly turn bad for him as longtime true friend and rival, Colonel Damon Waltrip, attempts to deprogram Humphrey to gain favor with the brass.
But the Major quickly figures out what's going on, and with the help of Wesley, the Cogman, puts an end to the uprising.
No, you don't get a break. You go where we tell you. You do what we tell you to do. I only have to say one word.
The word's catnip.
There is like something out of the corner of your eye. Wesley's been standing there, and you hear like this slight grinding sound.
He's getting ready to blow.
And when you look over there, his eyes are all bugged out to the point where around the whites of his eyes, you actually see the rotating gears behind his eyes. His cheeks are twitching. And he's like standing there, and he's like...
Is somebody behind him?
Nope. He's staring at the colonel.
They live. Yes. That's what it is. He sees something there.
It's as if the colonel had he triggered something to lock down your automaton so that he can't record anything or say anything. It's just you and the colonel.
He's going to say catnip and you're going to be fucked.
Yep. Before he says catnip.
Say glass monkey.
Are a chicken.
Glass monkey.
Isn't that his code word for his droid?
Technically, all he has to do is say one thing.
I know.
Break his mouth.
9.
All right. You dive across the desk to grab him. And he immediately jumps back and he's laughing. And he draws a pistol from his holster and has it pointed at you. It says, I suggest you calm down, Major.
Where did that come from?
You've been holding something this entire time.
What is it?
It's a mechanism with a button. And when you take your finger off the button, Wesley stops convulsing. It's you who are locking him down.
I'm going to turn off the thing that they turn on.
Okay.
For Wesley?
Yeah. Wesley snaps into action. He knows what's going on. And he basically says, it's all right, sir. As he lunges forward, grabs the colonel, spins him around, whips his hand up. You hear a crack. The gun falls out of his hand. And he's got his arm around his neck. He's holding him back. And he's got the other hand up. And he's basically just holding him there.
General Merrow comes in to welcome Humphrey back from his long mission overseas, and that's when the Major first hears about the Loyal Glass Movement. And, shockingly, that the General is part of it. He informs Humphrey that the vile corporation Thorn and Hearse has been using the military wrongly, that something bad is growing up like a black thorny plant from within the Empire and has to be stomped out. Thorn and Hearse has been programming Humphrey to spread havoc, wipe out the heads of the rebellion, plant the seeds of war against the world, and eventually push the button that will launch a worldwide war. Say that 5 times fast, Robbie.
Worldwide war! Worldwide war! Worldwide war! Worldwide war!
So then, exhausted from all he's learned, the Major returns to his home there at Fort Chamberlain, only to learn there's even more bizarre things. His primary mission overseas was to plant a lifelike automaton in the good graces of the royal family. Princess Anna Cleves is her name, and the original copy of the Anna automaton lives in secret in Humphrey's house.
It is certainly good to have you back home, sir.
Good to see you.
May I fix your dinner?
Yes, please.
I would be delighted. What would you like to have for dinner?
Surprise me.
Boo!
Wesley says, allow me, sir. I'll handle this.
He also has a dog named Flag and lots of hiding places for secret files and such.
Files he quickly locates and reads to discover he already had dossiers on the top 9 or so of the rebellion leaders against the evil American Empire.
All right. Each folder contains a complete dossier on the individual, last known location, that kind of thing, schooling, what the profession is. This one appears blank on everything like schooling, occupation, blank, blank. And there is a small tintype picture of the person. Abel Key, K-E-Y-E, is a black gentleman with white eyes.
Ooh, is he blind?
That was the one labeled the carpenter. The monster.
Still don't look at me.
Kind of funny.
Barnett, comma Martin.
who could that be?
Out of military thinks you're a monster.
Handwritten on the Martin Barnett file is grandson. The leader, Booth, comma Samuel. The contact, Jackson, Colonel Mitchell.
What happened to him?
I don't know.
The getaway. Okay. Rose, comma Molly. Change getaway. It's actually, I couldn't read my own writing. It's gateway.
Gateway.
Oh, because
God.
The orchestrator, Travers, comma William. The witch. And it should come as no surprise. The name on that dossier is Shade, Adrienne Booth. Booth, comma Adrienne, and then Shade in quotes. Has an entire medical history of her and how her father, Samuel Booth, actually gave her to the Empire to... not long after birth, so that she could be raised as a witch, and they did all the experimentation on her. There's a picture of her as like a 12-year-old girl with her head shaved and these really huge, painful-looking metal rods in her head with tubes coming off of them.
That was nice of him.
And the last one, the mystic, Stoddard, comma Charles.
You would think that would be enough.
That wasn't the end of this part of Humphrey's tale?
No. There's a secret visitor, remember? The monster who had been living in his house this entire time.
Oh, yeah, right. Victor Tarbant, an intelligent, well-mannered gentleman ghoul.
There's no need for the weapon.
I'll decide that.
Well.
There's not glass bullets in there.
I'm not concerned unless the bullets are glass. May I sit down?
There's bullets in there.
Never seen.
All right. He looks around as he like pulls the gloves off one finger at a time, you know. Goes and looks at the picture of you and your father and does one of these, smiles and kind of turns and looks at you. And
handsome boy.
He sits down, crosses his legs at the knees, and rests his top hat in his lap and just smiles up at you.
And you are?
Victor. Dr. Victor Tarbant.
A.K.A. the monster?
I didn't say that.
Stuck here. Damn your eyes.
Too late.
Movie reference.
Victor Von what?
Not Victor Von. It's Dr. Victor Tarbant.
How do you spell that last name?
T-A-R-B-E-N-T.
And what's the pleasure for your visiting?
My grandson is in those files, and a pupil of mine. I wanted to help.
Who could that be?
Who's the pupil?
Help what?
You're going to be part of a rebellion, yes? Overthrowing the evil
the two that are dead is
imperial
what he's
corporations, particularly Thorn and Hearst. I can see into your mind as clearly as you can see my face here. Don't toy, Charles, or Cecil, or whatever your name is.
Victor agrees to help the rebellion, so it seems, by helping Humphrey track down the others, though he does have his own agenda. His own grandson, Martin Barnett, is among those listed in the dossiers. So, there we have it. You're all caught up.
You should listen to previous episodes if you haven't, or re-listen to your favorites.
Yes, please do. And let us know what your favorite parts were so that we could, you know, do more of that kind of thing.
Oh, but not right away.
What? Oh, yeah, right. There are a few episodes already in the bank, aren't there?
At least 20.
Now, all that means is that the show's going to go on, folks. We're not going to end anytime soon. You got to stay tuned in to find out what happens. And of course, that doesn't mean that anything new won't happen. We're actually getting ready to be able to do some one-offs with some guest players. So if you like the game story and want to be part of it, that can happen. So stay tuned. And thank you so much for listening up to this point, at least.
Yes, subscribe, review, share, tell us about your feels.
Tell us about your feels. All right, so yeah, next week is our Trivia Spectacular, where we see how much of the guys remember of the last segment. And then we get right into part four of the story and find out from here what happens with Martin, Jameson, and the Colonel. Martin and Jameson are already together. Will they stay together? Who knows?
If you like our show and want to promote it on yours, feel free to use the promo located at the end of our closing credits. Don't forget, you can download a copy of this show or any of our shows at the website www.reekstories.com/thepodcast.
Yes, please do. And let us know if you have something you'd like for us to promote on our show. As you heard, this episode and the last one, we're starting to gather sponsors, other podcasts, people that we really like, and this not just blowing smoke. No one is paying for this. We're doing it because we like what they're doing. So, you know, please share with us. All right. So until next time, I'm Mike the Story Crafter.
And I am RBY2187, affectionately known as Robbie.
See ya.
Monstrous machines and greedy corporations. In a world of automatons and dirigibles and faster than sound sky trains. In a time out of time, where the Americas weathered multiple civil wars, where armies continue to watch from the brink of the next conflict. It is a reality where witches and ghouls live among thinking machines and walking machines that resemble humans. It's a role-playing game. It's a dramatic radio adventure. It's a comedy. It's the Steamrollers Adventure Podcast, available on iTunes or at RigStories.com.